Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. While many argue that we're in a post-truth era, some scholars argue that deception has always been ubiquitous. So in this hour, we'll get some truth about lying. But first, the makings of a scandal. Why are some perceived as big scandals while a rash of other wrongs are ignored? We're joined by Robert Entman. He's a professor of media and public affairs and professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. He is author of A Scandal in Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct, Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion, and U.S. Foreign Policy, and The Black Image and the White Mind, Media and Race in America. Well, welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Robert Entman. It's great to have you back here with us.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
I wonder if we should first talk about generally how the media handled the 2016 election. What's your assessment?
You know, it has to be preliminary, but my general assessment is they did perhaps a worse job than ever, which is, you know, kind of hard to believe in some senses. By that, I mean, and I'm talking about the mainstream media, and we do have to talk about the other media, but in the mainstream media, as far as I could tell, and I think this is backed up by Tom Patterson's research at Harvard on the coverage, it's even more of an overwhelming focus on the horse race and tiny amounts of attention to policy issues. So that's one critique I would have. And I believe the figure I heard was that on the three major broadcast networks, there were 32 minutes of attention to policy issues and 100 minutes of coverage on Hillary Clinton's emails. That's an astonishing figure that speaks to real problems with mainstream media operations, particularly given all the critiques that you know, we scholars have made over 30 or 40 years of that focus on the horse race. Second thing that we can say is that in doing the horse race coverage, they did a terrible job on that because they did not pick up all the uncertainty that ultimately led to Trump's winning the Electoral College. Now, I do like to always say he didn't win the election. The election was won by Hillary Clinton by over 1 million votes. But in America's somewhat peculiar system, or I should say quite peculiar system with the Electoral College, that's obviously where he won the election. And that distinction should have been probed better by the media and the currents that expressed themselves in the surprise outcome. So they did a bad job on that. Third, the way they handle scandals was itself scandalous, I would say. I just mentioned the emails, and we can get into that, but what's most troubling, it seems to me, is the failure to follow up the numerous individual reports on many, many Trump scandals. The only one that really got attention was, and this is predictable, the one where they had this sort of interesting video and audio evidence about his sexual stuff. So once again, you know, the sexual scandals are the ones that they love. I think one of the many, many mistakes the Clinton campaign made was focusing too much on that.
It's interesting about the Trump scandals. One of the things that I started to think about, and this is not reflected in the scholarship, is that there were so many of them that they got lost. Whereas yes. With Hillary Clinton, there was a single thing to focus on and they could just repeat it and repeat it. And it became this sort of meta narrative.
Exactly. With some help from Trump, who gave them some memes and I would say some help from Hillary in the sense that aside from the, you know, sexual stuff, Clinton barely mentioned any of the other things that she could have seized on. And if the opposition doesn't seize on it, of course, the candidate who has the scandals is not going to talk about them voluntarily. So by the bad strategic decisions, Hillary didn't feed the media's possible focus on the many, many things that came up with him. Is it a scandal that he didn't release his tax returns? Well, probably he's hiding things, and I haven't done the research, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was more attention to Mitt Romney's releasing his tax returns partially and some of the stuff that was indicated there than there was to Trump's non-release.
I was thinking that whole, when they go low, you go high, backfired on her.
I'm thinking of actually making that the title, or at least of a chapter in my new book. that is such a mistake, and it encapsulates the poor strategic thinking of, in general, the Democratic Party, and particularly the Clinton campaign.
As I understand it, that actually came from the Obamas.
Yes, and everyone loved it among, you know, many academics I know, and it's exactly the wrong thing.
You wrote a book, Scandal and Silence, about what is a scandal, what isn't a scandal, and really why it matters. We say we don't want to hear about scandals, but you think we should.
Although people may say they don't want to hear about scandals, in fact, they do, and that's one reason there is some attention sometimes to scandals, typically the ones that are easiest to understand and most sensational and typically about personal misbehavior. But why they're important is that's really the ultimate function of media in a democracy, is to keep the politicians and leaders honest. And we know that those folks, like any other human beings, are not necessarily automatically honest. And they're probably doing some things that are wrong and bad. And there really ought to be an eagerness to follow the evidence of misbehavior in office or in public life in some way. Journalists often congratulate themselves, always referring back to Watergate as if Watergate was the typical scandal instead of the one example of a scandal that brought down a president, when in fact they don't typically follow up many, many important scandals. That was true in this campaign, where there was so little attention to really serious questions about Trump's business career, not just his personal life and temperament. It's been true, I think, largely for decades since Watergate. They got that one pretty right. But since then, and the book explains why, it's not so easy to go after scandals. Often they're very complicated. Often it takes a lot of time. And by the time you get the truth, it may be too late. Let's say in this case, the election already happened. You know, I certainly grant that there are difficulties in exposing scandals in a timely and a sufficiently detailed way.
Two that you looked at were Benghazi next to what happened with 9/11. And 9/11 hardly got any scandal-type coverage, whereas Benghazi did. How do you explain that?
That's my most recent research on scandals. And I was struck by how much attention was given to Benghazi, where four Americans tragically died. And it certainly can be argued that the person in charge of the State Department, who's Hillary Clinton, bore some responsibility for that. However, the amount of attention to Clinton's Benghazi responsibility at the many hearings and coverage of this issue, it struck me that I don't remember the last time there was a really large attack by terrorists on American citizens. We call it September 11th. Obviously, it got enormous media attention, but not as a scandal. And the key thing here is that we have enormous evidence that George W. Bush was given numerous specific warnings about impending major terrorist attacks on 9/11. You know, the one memo that's been publicized is the one that says Bin Laden determined to attack the United States. That was only one of many briefings he and his top people were given. They did essentially nothing. Although I'm not saying he could have possibly prevented the 9/11 attacks, the fact that he did nothing to prevent them could easily have been quite a big scandal. And so what my research shows is that there's very little attention to the potential scandalous irresponsibility of the Bush administration and not doing anything about the 9/11 attack, compared to the enormous scandalized attention Clinton and to some extent Obama got over the deaths of four unfortunate Americans in Benghazi. And that seems to me an excellent illustration of the very phenomena that I've been talking about scandals not being calibrated to how serious they are, and the public really not finding out about many serious scandals.
Let's talk about why that is. One reason you were pointing to in your book is that the party that should be talking about it is not really talking about it in the terms that it should.
Actually, a terrific illustration is this comparison, because I think most listeners will remember that the Republican Party attempted to make Benghazi a scandal, no matter how many times they could fail to find any evidence that there's a scandal there. Nonetheless, there's yet another investigation by yet another congressional committee. And even when Republican-headed committees vote reports finding no evidence for any wrongdoing by Hillary Clinton, or perhaps minor wrongdoing, that was not enough. They kept it in the news. And that ultimately led to the discovery of the email situation, which was then, of course, became even bigger than Benghazi. And, you know, there's some evidence now that it was email that undid Clinton's campaign and therefore made Trump president. So this whole Benghazi scandal is quite an important thing, and it could be traced to Republicans' absolute determination to make this a scandal. That contrasts so clearly, and in the paper I give some examples, where Democrats absolutely avoided opportunities to turn Bush's treatment of the 9/11 warnings into scandal. Instead, they acquiesced in turning their attention to other matters, as did the media. Now, it is true that the Bush administration was, I have to say, quite brilliant at orchestrating media coverage so that the question of Bush's responsibility was only occasionally mentioned and quickly was moved on to something else.
I assume in that case, in 9/11, there were a couple of things going on. One is what you called a cover-up in your book. But the second thing is also the Democrats' fear of being labeled as a group that would politicize a national tragedy.
Yes, and I think that fear is somewhat justified. But of course, it leads us to the paradox that if a president makes an enormous mistake like 9/11, like allowing the 9/11 attacks and doing nothing about them, you can't criticize. If the president and secretary of state, and I should have said the secretary of state and national security advisor, were also culpable in the 9/11 attacks, because they're the president's top advisors. In this case, granting that Obama and Clinton deserve some criticism for Benghazi, so that becomes the big scandal, because it isn't a huge national tragedy. But the huge national tragedy, they get a pass. That may be a partial explanation, but I always like to say to people, do a mental experiment. What if Al Gore had actually entered the White House and the Republicans found out that he had ignored and his top people had ignored numerous warnings from their terrorism experts in the White House and in the State Department and in the CIA? The head of the CIA says before 9/11, they were pulling their hair out that they couldn't get the president and his people to focus on this danger. If the Republicans had been the opposition and Gore had been president, I think most people would agree that the party that was able to make Benghazi a four-year scandal would have found a way to make that negligence of the 9/11 warnings a major scandal, and they wouldn't have been scared of being attacked for politicizing something.
Then, of course, you've got the email so-called scandals, where Hillary Clinton had a server in her house. But there were some comparable things that went on during the Bush administration, weren't there?
Yes. Colin Powell actually, apparently, according to Clinton, recommended to her that she use a private email account. I don't know if he recommended the private server, but really the server is not all that relevant. The point is that the scandal allegedly was that she exposed national security issues by using this private email. Might have been less secure. Powell used private email that might have been less secure. He destroyed most of his emails before they could be investigated. Therefore, we don't know how many exposed potentially classified information. Furthermore, the Bush administration destroyed close to 2 million emails by a bunch of Bush administration people in the face of investigations, particularly involving Alberto Gonzalez, the former attorney general, and his illegal firings of some U.S. district attorneys. But the point is, again, the actual behavior matters less than the skill at politicizing and framing as scandalous. And the mainstream media are really vulnerable to manipulation on this score.
I think that new media plays into this. you're talking about mainstream media being vulnerable to the manipulation by the framing and attacks. They seem to just repeat what comes out in some of these social media, which then exacerbates the problem.
Now it's sort of a two-pronged attack that a party that's clever at manipulating the mainstream media can also have allies and also professionals who are helping them in the social media. And I would say 2016 does mark, aside from the whole Trump campaign itself, the other big thing that happened this year is the rise of social media and fake news transmitted by social media and websites. I was just reading some truly remarkable things about the sharing of fake news stories. My favorite one is that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump, which is like hard to believe, but nonetheless, this was shared a million times, far more than any other true story. In fact, at least according to my reading of one study by BuzzFeed, in most cases, the most shared stories were fake. And we're talking about billions of shares. And who knows how many, you know, visual impressions and how many people heard about these things. And this is different from the past. In the past, there could be rumors, but you actually had to like call up a friend and tell them this or write them a letter or in more recent years, send an email to a bunch of your friends. Now we're talking about this essentially broadcasting stuff. And, you know, when you add that to stuff that isn't fake, like the endorsement of Trump by the Pope, but there are other things that at least have a grain of truth. Let's say it's the Benghazi stuff. You know, people will share that over and over and over again, and that occupies their mind. And so what I consider to be a strange situation, like Trump being rated as more honest than Clinton. Strange because, you know, you can say a lot of things about Trump, but his record of dishonesty as a businessman is about as clear as any businessman in the history of the United States.
One of the things that seems to have arisen with this fake news is that there are these websites that promulgate this fake news that are in other countries, and they just make stuff up. And because it attracts money, they just keep doing it. So it's a little bit like the economic model completely gone awry.
Yes. It's interesting because our theory of the marketplace of ideas allied to the actual economic marketplace, there's an assumption that the demand will be for true news. And what we know about market economics is, well, but if the demand for the fake news is high, the market will respond and we'll get lots of fake news. And that's the genius of the market. The problem is that isn't quite what the idea of the founders were, I don't think, in promulgating the First Amendment. You know, both Facebook and Twitter, I guess, have talked about changing their algorithms to allow some forms of filtering of things that are obviously fake. But of course, there are many other cases where we're not talking about completely fabricated, but sort of one-tenth truths. And, you know, who are we going to vest with the power to censor that stuff? It's very tricky.
With the rise of fake news and the rise of social media, there's also simultaneously been such a discrediting of fact checkers and of anything establishment. People distrust these types of organizations that are actually trying to sift out the fact from fiction.
For many years, there's been a media literacy movement among educators, and I think it's now become more important than ever. And it has to include not merely how to read a newspaper now, but how to recognize that if you're seeing something just because it's on the web, in fact, maybe because it's on the web, you should be more suspicious. But it does speak, I think it speaks to two other things. Number one, one of our major political parties has proclaimed really that it's okay not to listen to scientific evidence and that kind of thing when it comes to climate change. And when it comes to, let's say, President Obama's place of birth, this is very damaging. I mean, apart from its partisan, you know, and my partisan feelings or whatever, it's a very damaging lesson to our citizens that it's okay to, you know, just go with your gut. And that's a problem. A second problem is there has been a decline in support for public education. Although our citizenry has more degrees than ever before, I'm not sure they're actually as well educated as they used to be. And I think that speaks to the lack of critical thinking skills that should enable people to reject some of the falsehoods.
I know you've also studied how race has come into this particular election and how we have been seeing race portrayed in mass media.
It's complicated because I think there's been, in the last couple of years, I think a lot of white people have learned something new about the police's treatment of particularly black people. And this is stuff that wasn't well known, I think, before among whites, and that has given a basis for some sympathy. On the other hand, it's clear from the success of Trump's campaign and many of his supporters and his willingness to name an outright racist and anti-Semite to be his top political advisor, that the white population of the United States, and this is not surprising, still doesn't have a great contextual understanding of the fact that racial discrimination still affects the lives of most black people. And so they don't have the sympathy and empathy that I think they could have if they knew more.
Robert Entman, it's always a pleasure to host you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs and professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. He is the author of Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct, Projections of Power, Framing News, Public Opinion in U.S. Foreign Policy, and The Black Image and the White Mind, Media and Race in America. When we come back, how to tell when somebody is lying. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. While many argue that we're in a post-truth era, some scholars argue that deception has always been ubiquitous. So in this hour, we'll get some truth about lying. Timothy Levine is Distinguished Professor and Chair of Communication Studies at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Deception. David Livingston Smith is Professor of Philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Bryony Squire-Thompson is a PhD candidate in the School of Psychological Science at the University of Western Australia. She is co-author of the studies Processing Political Misinformation, Comprehending the Trump Phenomena, and Correcting False Information and Memory, Manipulating the Strength of Misinformation Encoding and Its Retraction. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you all with us here talking about the truth of lying. I thought what we would start with is this idea that is in our media, in our dialogue right now, that we're in a post-truth era. This has largely been because of either the man who has been elected president to the United States, Donald Trump, or also because of the accusations of false news. And in the past, David Livingston Smith, you and I on a previous Scholar Circle and a couple of other scholars talked about really that lying and deception is relatively ubiquitous. So I wonder if we're in a different era. Is it more of the same? Is it less of the same? David Livingston Smith, what do you think?
Well, I don't think history is divided into two eras, really. I mean, this is an imposition of categories that we place to try and on history to try and make sense of things. Lying is a lying and deception, because I use the term very broadly, is indeed a ubiquitous feature of human life. And so it's not like suddenly we're launched into a time when truth doesn't matter anymore. But there are historical circumstances and political circumstances that I think, at least in this country, the United States, where I'm speaking from, make lying with impunity a lot more tempting and a lot more easy.
Easy and tempting because it's more permitted when the leader is also lying?
Well, no, I think any politician worth their salt is going to be a very skilled image manipulator. And lying is a form of image manipulation. And a skillful politician tells people, deceives them in the way they want to be deceived. Let's put it that way. And I think Trump has the salesman's instinct for doing this. And that's what I think is different. Not that political lying is something new. That's ridiculous. You know, we've known since Plato's Republic that lying is a crucial part of politics. Politicians, he said, serve up sweet pastries that are not nourishing but taste good. What's different is that Donald Trump has really established for himself and for others that he can push the envelope very far indeed if he tells people the sorts of things that motivate them in the way he wants to motivate them.
Timothy Levine, what would you say?
I agree with everything about Trump, but I would like to push back a little bit on the idea that lying is frequent in our communication. I tend to think, and I think the data shows pretty clearly, that most people are mostly honest most of the time. Most people lie less than the average person lies because lying's not normally distributed. There's a few people who lie a lot, and most of us are pretty honest. Even with politicians, if you look at things like, I haven't checked the PolitiFact numbers recently, but most politicians, when they get fact-checked, they don't always come out true, but they come out true more often than not. And Donald Trump's the clear exception of this. I don't know that there's ever been a politician that, in recent memory, that's been as close to his difficulty with the truth. But even then, remember, those are only the statements that get fact-checked. And there's a lot of statements that don't get fact-checked, primarily because there's no reason to fact-check them, right?
And one of the things in your research, Timothy, was that people lie when they have a reason to lie. And if that reason has been taken away, then they don't usually lie. How do we make sense of that?
Well, people lie or deceive when the truth's a problem. And for probably most everyday adults, the truth isn't especially problematic for us. For example, if I'm on the radio talking about my research findings, the reason I'm here is to explain that to you. You know, hopefully the truth's not a problem. You know, hopefully I'm not fudging my data or making up evidence. And if I were, it probably wouldn't make sense to have a show like this, right?
I wonder also, since you're in the communication field and one of the issues in communication deals with the idea of contagion, is contagion a problem when it comes to deception?
I don't know. Good question. But I do think the really insidious thing about the current political environment is not only the giving false information, but attacking the credibility of those who fact check, right? So now the fact checkers are the fake media. And this I find really troubling, because how are we to know what's true or not? And it seems to me that communication can only work with when we trust what others are saying, and we move towards anarchy if just anything goes.
Right. And that's something else you've written about, which is how much we actually need to be able to trust in order for our general society to function.
Yeah, it's really hard to be close to people or have good cooperative relationships if you can't trust them. I'm a professor. If students can't trust me, there's no reason to pay the high tuition dollars. That would be silly. Yeah, things unravel pretty quickly if we can't believe what other people say. If we have to trust anything, communication just loses all its utility.
Brioni, this might be the place to bring you in. Brioni Squire-Thompson, she's been studying when people accept or don't accept information that's wrong. What can you tell us about this process?
What we find is even if people are presented with these really good, valid, evidence-based corrections, they might update their beliefs in the short period of time. But if we measure it, say, you know, a week later, 3 weeks later, they start to re-believe in the original misconception. And I guess that's one of the phenomena that's pretty scary to think that we call it the continued influence effect of misinformation, because misinformation or, you know, these lies that people are presenting really do have an impact on our reasoning and memory, like well into the future.
Walk us through this. First of all, they hear the deception or the lie, and if they accept it, then what happens?
Right. So the way that we study it in the lab is we often present people with like multiple pieces of information. And we ask people to rate on a 0 to 10 scale, how much do you believe in, you know, in this piece of information? Once they've done their rating, we give them like a little blurb to say, well, this is actually true because of these reasons, or this is false. And then we measure participants over a period of time. And yeah, what we do find is they're quite happy to update their beliefs in the short term. But yeah, the corrections don't seem to last.
There was another study, which is depending on who was attached to the information, that had an effect on whether or not they continued to believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was actually a study that we did using Trump, because he was an incredibly polarizing figure. We set up these studies in 2015 and 2016, and he was obviously already a highly divisive figure. And we said, for example, one of the items was Trump said that the MMR vaccine causes autism. Or we just presented just the information saying the MMR vaccine causes autism, how much do you believe in statement? And we found initially straight off the bat, without correcting people's misconceptions, if people who are Trump supporters, they're far more likely to believe in the misconception. So what we think is happening here is that people are using political figures, people who they trust, as what we call a heuristic. So it's a mental shortcut for judging the veracity of information. So they're like, I trust Trump, and therefore I think what he says is true. And I don't think this is necessarily only for political figures or only for Republicans or Trump supporters. I think this is trust in source, and source credibility is a big thing when judging how true or false information is.
You know, it's interesting. It sort of goes hand in hand also with the work that some psychologists have done with the brain scans. And once people have become sort of wedded to a particular position or a particular candidate, they actually measured the cognitive dissonance that they experienced when somebody gave them counter information. David Livingston Smith, what do you make of this?
Well, there's contagion. Let's actually start with something a little bit more basic. You've sometimes spoken of lies and sometimes spoken of deception. And I think one of the differences between Tim and I is that Tim has a pretty fine-grained notion of lying. And I use lying as pretty much synonymous with deception. And I do agree with him, by the way, that most of the time we don't lie. If that were not the case, then lies would have no utility, as the story of the boy who cried wolf tells us. Okay, so contagion. I think maybe it's a little bit of a misleading metaphor. What happens, I think, is that prominent people who are looked up to, and in the case of Trump, looked up to as a sort of savior, set norms. They set norms of permissibility by their behavior. So if someone like Trump sort of suggests that one can play fast and loose with the truth, I doubt very much that this does not impact those who look up to him.
In that case, it would just be those that look up to him that would therefore be affected. It's not like it would create a culture of deception.
You know, these things sort of create a cultural atmosphere. And presumably there are a lot of psychological processes at work here, and I wouldn't presume to specify them. But yeah,
May I jump in? Sorry. When you're finished.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to mention that that's actually one of the things we measured in a study regarding Trump, when even if people who supported Trump updated their beliefs that what he was saying wasn't true, that we gave them correction and they were like, yes, we completely acknowledge that what he's saying is false. It didn't actually have any impact on their voting preferences. So people were just as likely to vote for him, even if they were acknowledging that they knew that he was spreading inaccurate information. What we assumed this meant was that why people like political figures is made up of a whole range of factors, but yeah, I guess being truthful in our experiment wasn't one of them.
Yeah, may I respond?
Yes, please.
That's pretty cool research. I think that what goes on with authoritarian leaders, and all the more for totalitarian leaders, is that the faithful followers see them as sort of being in touch with a deeper truth. So although the details might not correspond to reality, they're seen as articulating something which is true in a more profound and deep sense. That's one way that this problem gets negotiated.
Timothy Levine?
My theoretical perspective is called truth to fault theory. And the basic idea is that we tend to believe other people unless we have reason not to. So our default state is belief. And then at times we're motivated to think carefully about, is this true or not? So I think, for example, with the followers of a particular leader, they have a stake at believing this person. So they're decidedly not motivated to believe them. The other side of the political spectrum, they're scrutinizing. And so they're looking for it. If the statements aren't true, then they're more likely to try to fact check and look at that. It's a much more general principle that generally we kind of, you know, it's like when we're driving, we're kind of on autopilot. We're not really consciously thinking about things, right? And then something comes and grabs our attention. You know, some driver's behaving unusually or something, and we start thinking about it. Communication's a lot like this too. We tend to do it very automatically. And it's only when we have to really start thinking about, is this deceptive? Am I being lied to? That has to come actively to mind. If it's not prompted in some way, I use the word trigger, if it's not triggered. And one of the things that can trigger it would be a politician from an opposite party. One of the things that could trigger it would be a salesperson who's giving you a hard sales pitch. Maybe in certain kind of online dating environments or internet environments, you might be very on guard for people saying things that are false. But in most of our daily lives, this just doesn't occur to us. So this is why I think that we are much more likely to be skeptical of people who have different belief systems than us, or in different tribes or different groups.
Is this a problem in an age where there are massive numbers of websites that might proliferate information that's absolutely false?
Right. Or with, let's say, email phishing attacks. You know, if you're just going along in autopilot, it's really easy to click on those links. You have to be actively thinking about it. And actively thinking about it takes effort away from doing other things.
And so when you studied why people lie, because they had to have a reason, what were those reasons?
Yes. The exception is with pathological lying, which I define as lying without a reason. So occasionally you'll run into people who will tell a lie when the truth would work better. But for most of us, the reason we deceive is that for some reason the truth is a problem. Maybe we did something wrong. So transgressions are a big reason. We did something wrong. We're trying to hide it. We want to make a positive impression on other people. There might be some kind of economic advantage to it. You know, I want you to think my product's really better than it is, or I want you to vote for me. A surprisingly big one is a category my co-authors and all called avoidance lies. Basically, your friend or somebody wants you to do something. You don't want to go out to dinner with them for whatever reason, but you don't want to say, no, I don't want to go out with you. So you make up some kind of reason, like there's the vacuous, I have plans, or I'm sorry, I have a prior engagement, or something like that. But the truth is, you just don't want to do it.
So how ubiquitous did you find that this deception, this actual lying, occurred among people? Is it all the time, every day, or is it really rare?
I think most people don't lie very often. We've done nationwide surveys in both UK and US, where most people say they haven't really lied in the last 24 hours. And we gave them a pretty broad definition of it, just generally misleading another person.
Could they be lying about lying?
They could be, but there's been some cool validation studies to give people opportunity to cheat for a cash prize. And the people who admit to lying tend to cheat. And the people who say they're honest tend not to cheat in behavioral studies.
David Livingston-Smith, what would you say about all this?
I'm kind of skeptical. Every day I go to the supermarket, I'm asked by the usually young woman at the cash register, how are you? And I'm expected, like everyone else, to say fine. And I don't. And actually, they find it quite a relief because they're in a miserable job and they've been on their feet all day. But there's a great deal of that that goes on. I think people are generally unaware of the degree to which they lie. And bear in mind, again, that by lying, I don't restrict lying to deliberate statements intended to cause others to form false beliefs. I include in lying any form of behavior which has the function of causing others to form false beliefs. So I think lying is much more pervasive. And I think I agree with Tim that people lie. I mean, I would put it a little bit differently. The way he puts it is truth is a problem. I say people lie often to get things that they value, which they feel they can get more effectively by lying than by telling the truth. People want others to love them, to think well of them, and so on. But people also lie because they enjoy it. I mean, I hold as an example of that the stories that are told to children about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and so on and so forth, which seems to me a matter of the pure exercise of power of a big, strong, knowledgeable person over a small, vulnerable one.
That's interesting. Go ahead. Did you want to respond?
Oh, I was going to jump in. This is Tim. I tend not to see "hello, how are you, fine" as deception, because I asked David how he's doing, and he says he's fine. Yeah. I don't really believe he is. I know that we say this all the time, right? And there's no deceptive function. If I said, "How are you doing?" and he said, "I'm having a really great day," and he wasn't, then I might be deceived. But the everyday little politeness rituals we have, I don't think serve a deceptive function, because every member of the language community knows perfectly well that this is just what we say. And everybody knows that when you answer "fine" or "what's up, nothing," that means nothing more than I'm just following this mindless sequence.
Sure, but isn't that a refraining from telling the truth? So if you have someone who's there, basically feels like she wants to jump off a bridge, and I say to her, "How are you doing?" And she says, "Fine." She's not she is misstating. She's engaging in a social ritual, even though she is inside dying to let someone know what her life is like.
This is Tim again. We might be at the risk of jumping into a real rabbit hole here. We want to be very careful, I think, in talking about deception, not to conflate truth with deceptiveness, because I can be deceptive while being 100% truthful.
Of course. I agree.
Right? So I can say something sarcastically that I mean is literally true.
Yes.
Right? And I can say something absolutely false, like with sarcasm, that's not deceptive at all.
That's right.
So I think David and I are on the same page on what deception is. So deception is that which communication or other signals which function to mislead someone.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're actually on the same page.
Yes.
We just differ in the specific examples, like "how are you? I'm fine."
Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do is bring David Livingston Smith in on another dimension that he's also written about, which is about self-deception. David, you have said in the past that we are frequently in a mode of self-deception, and that perhaps this is to keep us from being sad or depressed or upset. What about that? Is there any harm done there?
Well, I'd like to broaden it out. No, I don't. There's not necessarily any harm done there at all. I think optimal self-deception is a requirement for keeping sane in this crazy world. Self-deception is a really complicated and difficult topic. There are problems. Philosophers have written a lot about this, like problems understanding how it could work and what it is and so on. And I'm not going to get into that. That would take an hour's lecture to begin to try and make sense of. But I think that the usefulness of self-deception is broader than what you specified. So truth can be really, really overrated. So let's start with what you said. Yeah, I mean, I'm wearing shorts that I got cheap someplace. They're probably made by people working at ridiculous starvation wages under horrible circumstances. And I know that, but I kind of don't pay attention to it. because if I paid attention to it, I would feel horrendously guilty and guilty that I'm not sufficiently politically engaged to try the hell to do something about these sorts of things. And I know I'm 64 years old. I don't have that many years left. I know I'm going to die. Oh, that's a bad thought. I can tolerate it occasionally. I know that my loved ones are going to die. I know that there's tremendous suffering around me. And I'm a darker person than most, but even me, I have to ignore that stuff in order to keep going. But, you know, self-deception can have other functions as well. The assumption that the truth is always better, to know the truth about yourself is always better, to know the truth about others is always better, I think is an unwarranted assumption. And self-deception can be the balm that helps us get through the night and helps us get what we want as well. Because, of course, if we believe our own bullshit, we're much more, presumably, much more effective at getting others to believe it.
Spoken like a true philosopher. What would the communication professor say?
I think self-deception is somewhat out of the realm of communication. But the work on self-deception I find really interesting is an evolutionary biologist by the name of Robert Trivers. He makes the same point that David made at the end, that the real advantage of self-deception is that it serves other deception. That if we believe our own bullshit, then we're way more believable. And I'm not sure how much I agree with Trivers' exact argument, but I find it really interesting. And I think if he's right about that, it turns at least a lot of the psychological research on deception kind of on its head.
Talk about a little of the costs of this, both on a person and on society in terms of communication deception. Tim, I think you mentioned that you can tell somebody's deception or they're lying, not by what they say, but why they do?
It's the exact opposite in my research. The principle that's guided most research on deception detection is that you want to not pay attention to what people say, and you want to pay attention to what people do and various nonverbal behaviors. And that view was characterized very well in the TV show Lie to Me that was on. What my research finds is the exact opposite, that if you're paying attention to how people are coming off, then you're very likely to be misled. But if you listen carefully to what they say, and if possible, fact check, if not, assess it for plausibility, hopefully understand what they say in the context in which it's said, then we're much better able to sort out truth from lie. And the other thing my research finds is that most lies that people detect are detected well after the fact. So we've asked people, think about a time you caught somebody lying to you and how did you find out? Something like 98% of those are found out later.
You looked at relationships as well in terms of how that occurs within relationships. What did you find there?
The big finding in relationships is it's not so much the lying, but what the lies are about. So when you lie about the wrong thing, that's really what damages the relationship. You know, if I'm lying to you about a surprise party, you're probably not going to, that's not going to hurt our relationship that much. But spouses who are lying about infidelity, that can really hurt the relationship once the lies are uncovered. But it's not just the lies, it's the underlying problematic things that were being hidden.
And Bryony, what are your findings with regards to this, with the deceiver or the person receiving the deceptive information?
I guess first I'd like to jump on the bandwagon of definitions of, I guess with my research, when I look into like misinformation, it isn't necessarily someone with the intent to deceive. So that could be coming back to like self-deception. Sometimes I think that people believe these lies so much that they do have a way of coming off as believing it is true, even if that's not the case. But yeah, misinformation, I mean, it could be deception, but it could also be just spreading inaccurate information that people like really do have a strong disposition to believe in first.
Well, I guess one of the questions for you in terms of, because you're mostly studying how people receive and process information, right? You're not actually studying the people who are lying. You're studying the reception of lying. One of the things I thought was so interesting, you were saying that they come back to their original state. During that process, when they are in the, oh, we found out this isn't true, but now we're going to go back to our original position, have you interviewed these people to have a sense of, do they have cognitive dissonance? Do they feel betrayed? Do they have this psychological effect?
I would love to interview them. I think my research is quantitative, not qualitative, but I think some of the most interesting experiences have been, I mean, I have quite a few studies done online, but when I was working in a lab, you actually got to speak with these people, and it was always very interesting, and people always had these queries of, well, am I remembering what you told me was true? Is that what I'm answering? Or am I still answering what I truly believe? And I do think that there, when we correct information, there's still a big disconnect between what people remember that, you know, a source told them and what they still believe. Yeah, it's definitely a very interesting phenomenon.
David Livingston Smith.
I think the whole idea of belief is a really interesting idea. I think a lot of times when people say they believe something, what they mean is they're committed to it. There's kind of getting behind it. And evidential considerations don't play much of a role in that. I mean, you see that in New England here with sports fans. They will say that they believe that the Red Sox are the greatest team in the world. And that's entirely unrelated to how well they're doing in a particular season, right? It's a gesture of commitment. It's like saying, go Red Sox, right? Similarly, you know, my students in Intro to Philosophy, when we look at philosophers' criticisms of the purported proofs of God's existence, and we see pretty plainly that those proofs just don't hold up, students will absorb that, you know, they'll understand the logic and they'll say, you know, but I still believe. And they believe because they were raised that way. That's the claim.
Sounds a lot like Bryony's research, like maybe for a moment they let go of that, but then they go back to it.
Yeah, because it's the commitment that matters rather than the evidence that matters.
Tim Levine?
I'm really understanding belief, and particularly when we believe other people's communication, is a really cool thing to think about too. In my research, I focused on what people do that make them believable. And it seems that what people do that make them believable is completely unrelated to whether they're actually should be believed or not. But there's this whole combination, whole constellation of behaviors that make people believable. And as it turns out, these things are all interrelated. So if you do these things, if you're friendly and you're confident and you're engaged and you know, you're looking the person in the eye, then pretty much almost everybody will believe you. And if you're not doing those things, if you're coming off as nervous and sketchy and adding a lot of, like we scientists do, a lot of qualifications, or we academics, because all academics do that, then this can undercut your believability. I find that fascinating at just how powerful these things are.
It's interesting, too, in terms of the political environment, because one of the things that in a previous scholar circle, they talked about the appearance of authenticity and the appearance of sincerity and how much of a role that plays. And when we're talking about Donald Trump, who is in the fact-checking world, what they would call pants on fire most of the time, but he comes across as he's sincere and authentic. How do you make sense of that?
I call it the believability quotient, and I actually have this checklist of 11 things. And I found, for example, that people who are both lying and telling the truth, or liars who do these things, even professional interrogators will get right only about 16% of the time. But when the people are honest and do the exact same thing, people are 100% right about them.
Wait, say that again. Say that again. I'm not sure I followed that. So you said that...
So if I'm coming off as really believable and I'm lying, even professional interrogators will be wrong about me 80%+ of the time. But if I'm actually honest in doing these things, then they'll be right about me. And the interesting thing is these show up cross-culturally. So I'm in Korea right now. I've replicated the findings here. So I show Koreans videotapes of Americans high in this believability quotient. They believe them, and low in it, and they don't believe them.
Bryony, what do you make of that?
Oh, yeah, I think it sounds like great research. I think that believability, you know, really does go hand in hand with deception and why people lie. You know, in a way, like it's the flip side. What we believe and why we believe it is, I think, there's so many working parts, and it's definitely like, large.
Yeah, and can I jump in?
Yes,
I would
please.
Love to see what's going on in the brain scanner when people are watching these highly believable people or watching these highly sketchy people.
Now, when you're talking about the high believability people who are actually lying, would that fall into the pathological side?
Not necessarily, I think. So at least in the way I would use the term, what makes lying pathological is that they're lying when the truth would work just as well. So there's no reason for lying. They're just lying to lie. And that's different than, I think, a really effective liar, a highly believable liar, who's doing it very strategically, or might be using it very, very strategically and very successfully.
Yes, please, Bryony.
Just on that note, and bringing it full circle back to politics and 2016 presidential campaign, when that is paired with our finding of even if people reduced their belief in the misinformation, they didn't change their voting preferences. It was actually a very effective strategy by the Trump campaign. I mean, who's to say whether or not it's an explicit strategy that was used, but if you're able to get all the benefits of this like additional news coverage and arousing rhetoric, and but you don't have the negative consequences of being caught out and spreading the misinformation, yeah, maybe perhaps a good way to go.
Final word, David Livingston Smith.
Yeah, well, with respect to believability, I totally agree. I mean, it's the skilled liar, the trick to being a good liar, a skilled liar, a competent liar, is to be believable. Otherwise, there's no point. So I can do no better than to quote one of my favorite philosophers, Marx, not Karl, but Groucho, who once said that sincerity is important. If you can fake that, you can fake anything.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
Timothy Levine is Distinguished Professor and Chair of Communication Studies at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Deception. David Livingston Smith is Professor of Philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Bryony Squire-Thompson is a PhD candidate in the School of Psychological Science at the University of Western Australia. She is co-author of the studies Processing Political Misinformation, Comprehending the Trump Phenomena, and Correcting False Information and Memory, Manipulating the Strength of Misinformation Encoding and Its Retraction. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.